This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Welcome to the program again this week. Joining me this week on the program is Ms. Ellen Brown. Ellen is the author of the book Web of Debt and the book The Public Bank Solution. She is here to talk about not only the history of banking, but also the current condition of the banking system. I think you'll want to definitely pay attention to that and be prepared to make some notes. Ellen is a very bright analyst and author. Also joining me on the podcast today, Joanna Negler. Joanna is the author of The Debt-Free Spending Plan. If you know somebody struggling with debt, Joanna has a unique and fresh approach. Looking forward to chatting with her as well. I do have a resource that I'm making available to all of our listeners. If you're not yet a subscriber to the Portfolio Watch newsletter that's delivered and distributed every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, you should be. That's one of the ways that we make this podcast available for free. All you have to do to become a subscriber and get our take on what's going on in the markets and in the economy is visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com. The website, again, is yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Ellen Brown. Ellen is a prolific author. She has written a number of books, both on the natural health and healing category, as well as medicine. She's also written the books Web of Debt and The Public Banking Solution. She has over 200 published articles. She has appeared on Fox Business Network and a number of other publications, stations, as well as a number of publications. She is an activist as well as an attorney, and she's joining me this morning from Los Angeles. And Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Dennis.
Ellen, let's talk about your book, Web of Debt. Can you explain to the listeners the premise of the book?
It's basically about how we, the people, have lost the power to issue our own national currency, that virtually all of our money is now created by banks when they make loans. And it's a process that goes back 300 years, at least, to fractional reserve banking based on gold, with when the Bank of England stepped in and became the issuer of currency for England. And then we followed that model with the Federal Reserve. So it's largely about the Federal Reserve and the populist movement of the 1890s to attempt to get government-issued money back in. In other words, they were going through a huge depression at that time, a depression or is due to contraction of the money supply, and the money supply had contracted because, first of all, greenbacks were discontinued. The greenbacks were issued by Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War, greenbacks were just U.S. notes. They were just money issued directly by the government, not borrowed from banks. And he did that because he knew that he was going to have to go heavily into debt to the banks otherwise, because they were charging him exorbitant interest. And so to avoid that, he just issued his own money. The result was, of course, the North won the war, but besides that, we had all this money to do things like the Transcontinental Railroad was built then, and the higher education system was set up. There was a great deal of infrastructure done with this money, and it was not what everybody worries that it would be, highly inflationary, but it wasn't. People will argue about that, and I could go into detail, but they cut back on the greenbacks, and then they cut off silver as a backing for the money supply, so it was only gold. So this radically contracted the money supply. So the populace marched for to go back to this system, to take back, to nationalize the banks, to create a central bank that actually served the people. What they wound up with it was the Federal Reserve, and William Jennings Bryan, who was the leader of the populace, thought it was so obscurely worded that he actually thought that it was what he wanted, something that served the people, that it was government issued money. But we now know it's not government issued money, it's bank created money, and they create 97% of the money supply today.
Ellen, I think there's a lot of listeners that probably don't completely understand the distinction between government-issued money and bank-issued money. In fact, it'd be interesting to see, for example, on a segment of jaywalking, how many people knew the Federal Reserve was not an agency of the government. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Government-issued money would be all we have of government-issued money, really, are coins, which make up a very small percentage of the money supply. But at one time, in the 1850s, coins were 50% of the money supply. And in the Constitution, it says Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof. And coins were then considered the national money supply. But they got shrunk and shrunk and shrunk as banks first issued. At that time, banks would issue banknotes, which were just promissory notes. So you could take your banknote to the bank and claim a certain amount of gold. But the banks quickly figured out that they could issue 10 times as many promissory notes as they had gold. So 9 out of 10 of those notes were, in effect, counterfeit or just bank-issued money. And these notes traded as if they were money because it was much more convenient to trade this paper than to carry around this gold, which was also unsafe and so forth. So the bank-created money just got larger and larger. And in the late 19th century, this new system was developed of deposit money. So the bank would create the money. When they made a loan, instead of issuing banknotes directly, a high tax was imposed on their banknotes by the Banking Act, the National Bank Act of 65, I think. The National Bank Act imposed a 10% tax on banknotes issued by local banks. And so what they started doing instead was when you took out a loan, they would just write it into your account, and you would have the right to issue checks against it. So that's where virtually all of our money comes from today, is that people take out loans, they go to the bank. The bank writes it up as a liability to themselves on one side of their books because they're going to have to they're going to have to move some reserves over to some other bank when you write a check to another bank. And they count it as an asset to themselves on the other side of their books because you have promised to pay that back with interest. So they say they haven't created anything. It just comes out to zero. But actually, all that money that they've created in your checkbook adds to the money supply. The way they define the money supply is M1 is coins, dollar bills, and checkbook money. So that's this money created by banks. And if you look at a chart of the money supply, you can see that the coins and dollar bills are a very small line at the bottom, and then there's this huge exponential curve going up of M2, which is bank-created money. So the dollar bills, you can say, what about those? I mean, that's also a very small portion of the money supply. They are technically printed by the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, but they're so the Federal Reserve pay, which is, as you point out, it's composed of 12 branches, all of which are 100% owned by the banks in their district. So in that sense, it's actually a private entity, and it's set up to backstop the banks. It's there to protect the banks. It's not there to serve us. It's there to serve the banks. So the Federal Reserve buys these paper dollar bills for the cost of printing them, which is something like 6 cents a note now, no matter what the face value is, even if it's like a $100 note. And then they effectively sell them to the banks, which then use them when people come for their money and they want cash instead of this checkbook money, then they'll have this paper money or coins to give them. But what do the banks use to buy the paper dollar bills with is checkbook money. So effectively, it's all created, except for coins, it's all created on the books of banks privately.
Well, Ellen, we've got a couple minutes left in this segment. If you look at quantitative easing, which was essentially money printing, there's been a lot of bank-created money that has been added to the system. What do you see as a consequence for not only our listeners, but maybe the banking system? And we can carry it over to the next segment if we need to.
Well, quantitative easing is not what it was cracked up to be. I mean, it was called helicopter money, as if they were flying helicopters over the people and dropping money onto Main Street. But they're not. Quantitative easing is just an asset swap in the reserve accounts of banks. So effectively, the only real effect it has had is it's driven up the stock market because it's given banks, you know, something more to play with, and driven up asset prices. But it hasn't actually stimulated the economy, which is still in the doldrums. What they should do, what I would say, what I think they should do, is something like Jeremy Corbyn is the labor leader in England. He's recommending quantitative easing for the people, where they would actually, the central bank would issue money directly to be used for infrastructure. And we could do that as well. We have a huge infrastructure problem, and we don't have the funding for it. So anyway, what people think it is and what it really is not the same, and it hasn't created hyperinflation like everybody expected, but it hasn't gotten money into the real economy either.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Ellen Brown. Her website is ellenbrown.com, and we'll continue our conversation with Ellen when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. Don't forget, next week, joining me on the Everything Financial Radio podcast is Mr. Mish Shedlock. Always look forward to my conversations with Mish. I'm chatting today on the Everything Financial Radio program with Ellen Brown. Her website is ellenbrown.com. Also, you can find a bit of what she's involved in by visiting publicbankinginstitute.org. And Ellen, let's pick it up where we left off. Let's talk a little bit about your work with publicbankinginstitute.org. Tell the listeners about it.
The Public Banking Institute was set. Actually, I started writing about the Bank of North Dakota in the late 2008 when we had the big banking crisis, and I knew that North Dakota was the only state that had a state-owned bank, a publicly owned bank that was set up with a mandate to serve the people. It partners with the local banks. Basically, North Dakota is a very conservative state, so to them it's not a socialist engine. It's actually keeping their money in the state to serve the people of North Dakota. It was set up in 1919 during when they had the farmers were in a big depression, and they were losing their farms to the Wall Street bankers, and they were crippled by having to use this railroad system that was it was one big cartel. It was actually a Rockefeller cartel, the Rockefeller Bank, the Rockefeller Railroad, and the Rockefeller Granary. So they started going west instead of east, and they set up their own granary, a publicly owned granary, which is still there, and a publicly owned bank, state-owned bank. So I was watching them, and they were the only state, by the spring of 2009, they were the only state that had escaped the credit crisis. Every other state had gone into the red, and North Dakota was still reporting record profits. I mean, they had a surplus, and they were trying to figure out should they add social services or should they cut taxes. I mean, they were the only state in that position. So I started writing about what their bank had to do with it, and that proved to be quite popular, and so I got so much email I couldn't answer it. So a friend said, well, why don't you set up a Google group, and then they can talk to each other, and you don't have to talk to them. So I did, and we got, over the next couple of years, we got a lot of heavy hitters in this Google group. There were bankers, and there was one woman from the Federal Reserve. I mean, we had a lot of people who knew what they were talking about, and after 2 years, we felt like we had the answer, and it was time to quit talking and get out there and start doing something. So we set up I didn't actually do it. We met in somebody's home, and pretty soon we had an institute. So we set up, we set up a website, and that generated a lot of interest. And within the first 2 years, we had 20 states that had introduced bills of one sort or another for a publicly owned bank. And we're still working on it. We've now got many states working on it and many cities are now, or, you know, groups in cities that are approaching their legislators and legislators that are working on it. In Philadelphia, they just introduced a bill to do a feasibility study on a Philadelphia-owned bank, and they've done a feasibility study just recently in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm working on it, of course, in California. So we're still working on it, but we haven't managed to get any passed yet. So we're at the sort of nuts and bolts stage. We understand now what we need to do. We need to actually come up with business plans, cost-benefit analysis, the sort of things that legislators need before they're so conservative. Even if you have a good idea, they're not going to run with it unless they have a big constituency behind them and they know they've got all those things in place so that it'll fly with the other legislators. So that's where we are now, and we're trying to build up public awareness. The problem is that most people just don't understand how banking works. So if you say we should have state-owned banks, they'll say, I don't trust the government, we don't need more banks, that sort of thing, because they don't really understand what you're talking about. What you're talking about is we want to take back the power to create money. We want to keep banking local, keep our money local, use it for local purposes, public purposes. Right? But Wall Street has gotten such a bad name that, you know, right now there's a lot of push for public banking because Wall Street is just so corrupt, and we've just seen one thing. Well, even the movie The Big Short, you can just see, you watch these people and you think, are these the people you really want handling our big monies, like our not just our personal money, but our government's, our local government's money? So anyway, we've got a lot of impetus. Next month I'm going to Europe where I'll be speaking in Wales. I was invited to Wales to speak on public banking because they think they need a public bank. And I'll be speaking in London and Manchester. I was invited to Iceland first, and then because they wanted a public bank. And, of course, they used to have nationalized banks, and they got into trouble when they privatized their banks. And then London, Manchester, and Wales. So I'll be speaking in four places next month.
Ellen, let's talk about the banking failures that we saw here in the United States. There was a government bailout. We've seen same problem, different solutions in Cyprus, Greece, and the Ukraine. Are you forecasting more banking failures moving ahead?
Yes. Well, they're setting up this whole system. Why are they even setting it up if they're not forecast? They, whoever they are, the powers that control our banking systems, under they're called orderly resolution schemes. And the G20 agreed on this orderly resolution scheme in November of 2014, where all the countries agreed that instead of doing bailouts, which, of course, were highly unpopular, the politicians didn't want to do these bailouts either. So they're escaping liability by they'll be doing bail-ins. Well, what that means is they take the money of the creditors, and little known to most people, we, the depositors, are the largest class of creditor of any bank. So we saw that the shot across the bow was in Cyprus, where they took, at first they were going to take a percentage of all the depositors' money, and there was so much protest against that they wound up taking 50% of the deposits of the depositors over 100,000 euros, the insurance limit. Well, these were like the local businesses that have to keep a lot of cash around to pay their payrolls. So a lot of businesses went out of business, or they really downsized and laid people off. It was horrible for the economy, and it was quite a disaster. And now in January of this year in Europe, last year they were having bail-ins where they were taking the stockholders and the bondholders' money, but now they're actually this year they're starting to take the depositors' money as well. And last year, this made the news in November when a pensioner committed to hanged himself and left a note blaming his bank because he lost 100,000 euros, which was his whole life savings, in a bail-in. He had bought bonds, but it was like his bank, where he had banked for 50 years, totally trusted them and bought their bonds. And So that's what we're looking at. And in the U.S., in many ways, we're more vulnerable than in Europe, because under the Bankruptcy Reform Act of 2005 and the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, derivatives go first in a bankruptcy. It used to be that the depositors were the first in line; they were the senior creditors. But now the derivatives claimants go first. Well, who are they? They're the banks and the hedge funds and, you know, the big players betting against each other. That's what derivatives are. And they have huge claims that far exceed, you know, the potential downside of these derivatives far exceeds the money of any bank, even the largest banks. I mean, they have like $1 trillion in deposits, or J.P. Morgan Chase has a bit over $1 trillion in deposits. But they have, I think they have like $60 trillion in derivatives. That's notional value, but still the downside is very high. So that could wipe out the whole deposit pool, and there could be nothing left. Even though you're FDIC insured, the FDIC insurance fund stands in line also behind the derivatives. So you have the derivatives, and then the state and local government money is secured like the derivatives, but they're behind the derivatives. And so is the FDIC fund, which only has $67 billion in it at the moment to insure $6.5 trillion in deposits. They have a $500 billion credit line with the Treasury, but that's just a loan. Somebody has to pay that loan back. It would be the taxpayers, no doubt. But technically, it's supposed to be the premium payers, who are the local banks. Well, that would break the local banks if you forced them to pay that kind of a, you know, if they raise their premiums to cover a big hit like that.
Well, Ellen, we're going to have to leave it there. I'd love to have you back on the program. That's information that people need to know, and I'm sure many of our listeners are not aware of it. Ellen's website is ellenbrown.com. You can check out publicbankinginstitute.org as well to learn more about her work. And, Ellen, thanks for a lot of important information, and, again, hope you'll come back.
Okay, thank you, Dennis.
Stay tuned. I'll be back in just a moment with Joanna Nagler.
Give me your money, honey. Just give me money.
Money. This is the Everything Financial Radio podcast. Again, a reminder, our podcast is supported when you subscribe to our Portfolio Watch newsletter. You can become a subscriber for free, and we'd appreciate it if you did that. All you have to do to subscribe is visit yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have on the program as a first-time guest Joanna Nagler. Joanna is an author, freelance writer, painter, and singer-songwriter living in the Bay Area. She's the author of the Amazon Top 100 book, The Debt-Free Spending Plan, and she has an upcoming book, How to Be an Artist Without Losing Your Mind. She has written and worked for ABC and Fox Television, the periodical Real Talk LA, the Jewish Journal, and more. And Joanna, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Dennis. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us, Joanna, what motivated you to write the book, The Debt-Free Spending Plan?
Well, this is a great story, actually, because I think I called myself a debt cycler. I would sort of cycle in and out of debt, and most of what my debt was about for me was that I just wanted free time to do some creative things. So I would have a day job. I worked in the nonprofit fundraising industry, and I'd have day jobs, and I consulted, and I'd sort of go for a while and pay off my debt, and then I'd get rebellious, and I'd decide that I needed more time or more freedom, and so I'd run up debt in order to fund that, and it was a cycle. I'd go in and out of it. And the pressure that it caused in my relationships, just in my daily life, got greater and greater. And each time I'd cycle through, it would be a bigger and bigger experience. And then the last time, it sort of tanked on it. I made a music CD, and I used my credit cards, and just really ran up a lot of debt, like twice as much as I was earning. And when that happened, I fell on my face. I lost my writing gigs, and I really had to take a hard look at what was going on in my life. And so I realized I was going to have to come up with something simple to live within my means. And when I went out looking in the literature, what I saw was a lot of information on how to invest. And to me, that was like telling a drowning person who can't float to swim to shore. It was like saying, hey, get out of debt, that's a bad idea. It's like, well, no kidding, right? Like, I didn't know that already. But And the advice was, here's how to invest. And that was so far from my range of my ability to take that in that it was just useless. So I would read some of the, you know, big names in finance and put the book down after the second chapter. So after a little while, I began to put together what I called my five-minute-a-day spending plan, something for people who hate numbers and never like math and really don't have a big bandwidth for their finances. And I also realized something else, Dennis, that, you know, I'm a really bright person. There are lots of really bright people who shut down around their money because we have an emotional relationship with our money. We think there's not enough, and if we look deeply into our finances, we'll never have another fulfilled want the rest of our life. That's our relationship to it. So it's not that we're not bright or we can't add. It's that we have this reaction to it, so we just sort of bury it in the sand. It's like in a relationship when you have trouble that you can't deal with, you sometimes just bury it. That's what we do with our finances. So I realized for myself I had to come up with something that was simple, and that really, literally, I could do in 5 minutes a day. So I began to craft this tool, and then I began to share it. And then one of my girlfriends said, hey, you need to write this down. This saved my marriage. It changed everything for me. This little plan is a game changer. So I thought about it for a while, and I thought, okay, well, you know, I'm an arty person. I'm a creative person. I thought, well, let's see if I have something to say. And I sat down and started to write the book and realized I had a lot to say. So that's how the book was crafted.
Joanna, you make a big promise in the book. It's to help you get out of debt in just 5 minutes a day. Can you give the listeners some idea as to how that's possible?
Sure. So one of the things that we need to do just is to get clarity. You know, we have a phrase in this debt-free world that vagueness creates drama, right? And so this putting our heads in the sand, vagueness creates drama, and it creates hurt and pain and pressure. And so the first thing is to get clarity. And if we're going to get clarity, for a lot of people, they don't want to spend hours and hours and hours putting the last 5 years of their receipts into QuickBooks, right? So I have a tool. It's a really simple tool. You can do it on paper. You can do it on a Word document. You can do it on a tech tool like Quicken or QuickBooks. And all it does is separate your bills from your daily needs, ask you how much you earn, and invite you to learn how to live within your means. Now, what that means is I call it using creativity, not credit cards, right? So what we're after is to give up the cycle of, oh, my God, I'm in debt. I'm in over my head. I'm never going to get out, and I'm going to put my kids' camp costs on my credit cards anyway because I don't know what else to do. We have to break that cycle. And so the only way we're going to break that cycle is to really get a realistic look at what it is we have and to invent some more creative ways to pay for what we need. So I like to say that my plan is not like a diet. Like I read some books that said, okay, you're never going to go out to dinner until you pay off all your debt. Well, that might be 6 years, you know. I don't advocate that. I advocate that what you want to do is live with what I call proportional spending. If after you pay your bills, you only have $800 to live for the month, you're not going to be in the market for a $225 haircut. Am I saying that you can never get a haircut? No. I'm saying be a little more inventive about how you cover the cost of the things that you need every month. And you're an adult. It has to be proportional. So I'm not going to spend $300 on golf when I only have $900 after my bills to take care of my family. Does it mean that I could never play a golf game? Well, that's not what it means. We're going to allocate money for everything you need and want. That's the key to making this work. I'll give you a really good example. My husband and I have multiple savings accounts. So when we first started this together, so I had all my debt to pay off, and then when we came back, we have an interesting story. We were married. We got divorced over our debt and our lack of choices, and then we got back together and married each other again with a promise to never use credit cards again. And it has absolutely changed everything, Dennis. I like to say we have money choices, but we don't have money drama. Literally in 9.5 years of being back together, we've not had one fight over money, not one.
Joanna, we're going to pick it up again in the next segment. I'm going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Joanna Negler. She's the author of The Debt-Free Spending Plan. Her website is anartistrylife.com. That's anartistrylife.com. And we'll continue our conversation with her when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Without further ado, I'll get back to my conversation with Joanna Nagler. My guest on the Everything Financial Radio program today is Joanna Nagler. Joanna is the author of The Debt-Free Spending Plan, and we're chatting with her about how you can create a plan that'll get you out of debt in just 5 minutes a day. Joanna, I have to be devil's advocate here. Is this just a sneaky way to get people to budget? Is this a budget called by some other name?
No, I say I don't use the B word anywhere in my book. Because what a budget says to us, particularly as debtors, particularly as people who've been using credit cards to extend our income and fund our life and, you know, all the pressure that goes with that, a budget says shortage, right? It's like putting yourself on a diet. You know, we can put ourselves on an incredibly strict diet for maybe a month, maybe three at the outside if we've got a lot of willpower. And then if it doesn't include the things that we enjoy about eating, we go off the diet and we're back to where we started. That's what we're trying to avoid, is that mentality. And so one of the things I say in my book is, I'm not going to tell you what's important to you. This is up to you. I'm providing a strong yet flexible tool. If it's the coffee bar over the yoga studio, I don't care. You have to do it. You're the adult. So I'm going to help you create what I call proportional spending, which is, if you, like, when I sat down to do this with my husband when we were dating, I said, okay, and he had a very modest income. He worked for the school district, and I had a really modest income, and so we were going to put these two modest incomes together to live in a very expensive place to live, which is the San Francisco Bay Area. And I said, okay, how much are you spending at the coffee bar? And he said, and we looked at it, and he said, well, I'm spending $150 at the coffee bar a month and $160 going out to lunch. And I said, well, what do you want in your life? And he said, I want a new computer, I want to travel more, I really want a travel account, and he had a couple other things. I said, okay, well, what would happen if, instead of having a frou-frou drink at the coffee bar, you just got a cup of coffee, and you still had the enjoyment of going there and getting the cup, blah, blah, blah. So we figured out that he needed about $40 a month for the coffee bar, and the rest he could put in a travel account. And so the first time we went away on a weekend, and that was something that we loved to do but never had the cash for and put on credit cards, we went away for a weekend, and we stayed at a nice place, but a modest place, but it was nice, right? And we came back, and we had not spent all the money that we had, and we had put everything that we had spent, we spent in cash. We felt like we were on top of the world. We looked at each other and just cracked up, like, oh, my God, we can do this. If we're thoughtful, we can do this. Now, we have to think proportionally. If we have tons and tons of money, we don't necessarily have to think proportionally about our daily needs. But most of us are not in that category. Most of us want to have some money ease in our relationship in our life. And the way to do that is to have proportional spending, is to think about what your needs are, what your bills are, what your daily needs are, and then to thoughtfully put money aside for the things you love. Now, I'll give you another really good example of that. Our two issues in my marriage where mine were clothes and his was going out to dinner. So unlike a diet where you shortage everything, we have to account for those things that would make us want to debt and rebel, that would make us want to put expenses on credit cards. So what we do every month is we set aside a little chunk of cash for going out to eat and having cocktails with each other. It's part of our little romance thing. Not a lot of money, but it's enough to go out, you know, once a week, right? We don't go to a swanky place. Maybe once a month we do, but we get out of the house and he can take me out for a cocktail or a nice little meal. Me, I never set money aside for my clothing. I always felt like I had to rob from my food money or, you know, my fuel money to buy clothes. Now I'd set aside just a little chunk of change. When I started out in my spending plan, I only had like $25 for clothes. Now I have like 60 or 80, depending on the month. I mean, I have a creative life. So for me, to downsize my spending plan so I can write a book, I don't really need to spend $200 on clothes if what I'm buying myself is time. So that's another really strong piece to the spending plan. If you have something you want to do, you want to write that Nepalese trekking book, you want to go to South America to, teach in a school for 3 months, the spending plan is a beautiful tool for downsizing your spending so that you can do something that's more meaningful to you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Joanna, that's great. Let me jump in here because we've got about 3 minutes left here, 2.5 minutes left. What advice would you give to those who are just starting their careers? You know, you mentioned that finances was really a source of stress in your marriage, and this pending plan has helped you overcome that. What advice would you give to someone just starting their careers? How do you make sure you don't create problems in your personal financial life?
I would say, first of all, particularly if you're not inclined toward investment in money and tech tools, read my book. It's written, I mean, the highest compliment somebody paid me was that it's written the way I talk. It's very human. It's not dry. So you can read it and you can see examples of before and after of people who were spending way too much money each month or way over what they were earning and were able to downsize their spending in ways so that not so that they could be good little citizens and be patted on the head, but so they could have more of what they wanted. What did they want? Did they want to take a trip every year? Did they want to have, chrome for their Harley? Did they want to invest in their CD collection? You know, I don't know. It's up to you. But we want to have a thoughtful approach to our daily needs, our food, our fuel, our drugstore items, not so we can just be good kids, but so that we can go out in the world and have what we want and build what we want. That's what I would say. Have clarity. Get a tool of some kind to live within your means. Make it easy on your soul. That's what my book is all about. 5 minutes a day. That's about as long as we want to put our head in this. 5 minutes a day, and then go live.
Well, Joanna, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Let me remind the listeners again that Joanna's got a couple different websites you can check out. One is Ann Artistry Life. That's anartistrylife.com. And also debtfreespendingplan.com. That website, again, is debtfreespendingplan.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. Joanna, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dennis. It was really a pleasure today.
Well, that's our podcast for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Tune in again next week.